Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Ken McKee, and welcome you to Nature's Talk Show and tonight's episode of Habitats of Nature. Before we get into the show, though, I would like to invite everybody to please go and visit www.naturestalkshow.com and get in on our live chat room tonight, because our co-host here, Ken Borman, is in the chat room right now. So, hello, Ken Borman. How are you doing tonight?
I'm very well, thank you, Ken. Yes, I am waiting with bated breath in our chat room. If anyone's got any questions, please come in and ask them, and I'll convey the questions through to Ken, and we'll see if we can answer them for you.
All right. Thank you very much. Now, one of the cool things about Habitats, Ken, is as we visit around the world, is I had the opportunity as I was growing up as a kid to live in an area that had some remnants of a once greater habitat. I got to spend a lot of time in this habitat. Believe it or not, we used to go to it to just to take pictures, you know, just different times of the year. That's all we would go there for. And that, of course, is the beech maple climax forest of the central Midwest. Now, you've been to remnants of one of these forests, I believe, haven't you?
I've been in one, Ken. The local area around me is a remnant Carolinian forest, which is very closely associated with beech maple forest, but it is different.
Yeah.
However, a lot of the same undergrowth plants occur in both, and obviously the same, basically the same animals occur in both, too.
Yeah. Well, this is always a fun place to go up and visit, because as we went through the different times of year to check it out, what it actually was, tonight for our listeners, we're calling it a visit to Ginn's Woods. And Ginn's Woods is about a 15-20 acre plot of original beech maple forest in that part of Indiana. I believe it's in Delaware County. It was owned by Ball State University at Muncie University, which is the college I went to, Ken, to study ichthyology and geology.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's really, I used to go out there all the time to hang out. One of the cool things I got to do as a kid between 8th and 9th grades is being a geek. I was one of three kids from my school, and each school got a couple of students that got to go to this special summer class for the gifted for science. And we got to take advanced classes that put us into, when we entered 9th grade, believe it or not, college-level molecular biology.
Wow. What a great start that would have been.
Yeah, well, you can see where it's taken me.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a very good start, and because I learned scientific method, you know, before I went to high school. And there I majored in the life sciences, biology, zoology, and botany. And, of course, that was one of the reasons I studied Ginn's Woods, was because I had such an interest in zoology and botany. And it led me to almost 12 years, I believe. I got to thinking about how many years that we spent time visiting. You know, from winter to spring, summer, fall, back to winter, you know, just checking out how the succession of the forest itself, how it come alive in the springtime, you know, and it was really cool. But, you know, that area wasn't always a climax forest, you know. Once upon a time, was glacier.
Yeah. right. That would be the very seven reaches of the glaciation, wouldn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, I lived about a quarter mile south of what was called the Muncie Moraine, back at Muncie, by Muncie, Indiana, part of Delaware County. And the Muncie Moraine was the southernmost extension of the last Wisconsin glacier. It was the southernmost where the ice age pushed down to the from the south, or to the south. And the moraines, of course, were the glacial till and stuff that was pushed in front of the glacier as this mile high wall of ice made its way south, you know, because ice can flow. And as the glaciers retreated, you know, different things happened. As we could travel from when I lived in central Indiana, we could travel up north, coming closer towards your area, but like in central Michigan and stuff. And you could see a transition, like you mentioned, you're a beech maple forest where you're at in Canada. We're slightly different from the central Indiana one because the topography is a little bit different. The climate's slightly different. So it adds just that little twist and flavor, I think, to those areas.
Yeah, I think where I am is like the southern extent of the Carolinian blending with the beech maple, whereas you're the northern section, or actually the western section, I guess, from what I've read, of the beech maple forest, because it extends right to the coast, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The east
yeah.
coast, I should say. And,
yeah.
And you've got a little bit of influence of the Carolinian coming down when you get to Michigan and all.
Yeah. Yeah, because I've mentioned before, you know, a place called Yankee Springs Recreation Area. And
mm-hmm.
Going through that area, you could see some of the kettles and potholes, you know, left by the glaciers as they retreated, you know. And since that land was pretty much untillable, it still had remnants, you know, the original trees there. And the fauna or the flora itself was fascinating because I think I found the highest concentration of maidenhair ferns in any locality inside these kettles. Now, for our listeners out there, kettle, of course, is a geologic term, and what it refers to is a large block of ice that got embedded in the soil, I guess you could say, or in the ground. And as the glaciers retreated, these large blocks of ice would melt, and they'd leave these big old interesting depressions, almost kettle-shaped. And some of them were low enough to the water table that they actually formed lakes. I actually fished in a couple of those, and those lakes are interesting. We'll have to talk about some of these one time because that habitat is fascinating. But anyway, back to the beech maple forest. But now, in Indiana, where I grew up as a kid, I was able to see the succession from a open plain or prairie, basically. A lot of times it was an old farmer's field, which could be, you know, I guess an analog to an open place, you know, open space. And it would go through several different stages to get to finally the climax forest. Took a couple, you know, take a long time, century or more, for this to swell, even a little bit longer, sometimes several centuries, because you have to cycle through a couple successions of older trees that get kind of old. And they stay alive for a long time, like the oak tree. But I guess the first stage, Ken, that we saw in Indiana, they call it like the Hawthorne stage. And these fields would start being reclaimed by such small shrubs or small tree growths like the Hawthorne and also wild roses. And they would start, this is a stage to the forest, because what there's an interesting thing about plants, as we were talking about yesterday on the Fine Art of Paleontology, you remember, we talked about you know, the plants reaching for the light,
right?
Yeah, and you know, and it was one of the this is what we see happening in a climax forest. Basically what it is plants reaching for the light, you know, which one can outreach this, you know, in the end. And that's when we end up the climax. For that. I guess that's a good way to put it, huh? Which one can...
It is, actually.
Yeah, outreach the other one.
So the hazelnuts are establishing a canopy, would it be fair to say, that enable the other plants to gain a foothold against the grass?
Well, the hawthorns, basically the hawthorns is a little kind of apple tree. Yeah, they have the spines, you know. You ever got stung by one of those spines?
No, I haven't had the... displeasure.
Okay, for our listeners out there, I've had the displeasure of getting stung too many times by these. It happens when you're wandering out through the woods and, you know, and stuff like that when you're, well, we were young, because we just, we'd go through these hawthorn areas. And sometimes the hawthorns would be growing quite close together. And you'd find yourself like, how did I get in here? Was I not paying attention? You know, and mm-hmm. But anyway, they're covered with these spines. And these spines have a poison on their outside. And when it jams into your skin, it'll burn and hurt, sting for an hour or more. And leaves a really bad puncture wound, too, you know. And,
wow.
Oh, man.
I would never have thought anything like that.
Yeah, at least, and it usually happens quite accidentally. You'll move a branch and it'll swing back and smack you, or you're walking a little too close to the person in front of you and they'll release a branch, and next thing you know, whack, boy, you get nailed in the chest or the arm or something, or the leg. But these are one of the first steps, and what it is, they start, when you're looking at the open field, you see a lot of grasses and other plants like that that love the open light. And these here, as you mentioned, they start the shade cover. They only grow at about 15, 20 feet tall, but that's shade, you know. That starts putting these shaded areas. So that starts weeding out some of the plants that don't like shade. They like the full sun. So we start seeing the plants that like partial shade. Those are the ones that start popping up in the understory.
Mm-hmm.
So now, as we move on to the next stage, what we see here are trees that can tolerate a little bit of the shade, but not much, but they can outgrow the hawthorns. They can replace them as reaching for the light. They can outreach them. And what we start seeing here are trees like some of the nut trees. Hickory trees was one of the first ones we would see starting to fill in an old growth. Sometimes we would see walnut trees, the black walnut that grows back east. They would start filling in.
Are these quicker growing? Or just stronger growing? Okay.
They were stronger growing, basically.
Okay.
They were just, just a good, strong hardwood tree. They grew, not super fast, because the wood is a hardwood.
Mm-hmm.
Another tree that we would see sprouting along with these as well were the oak trees.
All right. Mm-hmm.
And it was called the oak hickory forest. Now, these trees are interesting because the nut trees didn't seem to be too picky what grew underneath them in the canopy, you know. They would shed their nuts. And we found interesting is like on a walnut, when it was dropped, a walnut, for our listeners, black walnut, is an interesting tree. The fruit on it has a real hard-shelled walnut inside. Have you ever seen a black walnut, Ken?
Yes, they're coming up here. Actually, they're kind of like a pest tree up here.
yeah.
If they're on your property.
Well, you can sell the wood. You know, the wood.
Right.
Yeah, the wood. Matter of fact, people will do that. They'll clean out some of the black walnuts that they don't want. And I had a friend that had several black walnuts growing on their property, and they didn't sell all of them that they had, but they sold enough to, I think, for about $1,000 a tree.
That's all right.
Yeah. And, you know, because I've worked with walnut, too. I used to do woodworking in school. I used to love woodworking. It's a fascinating thing. And black walnut was fun to work with. But at any rate, these fruits have a green I don't have the book on trees in here to see what they're called. But at any rate, they're covered with this growth that when they drop off, it will rot, and it seems like that rotting actually helps the nut to the tree to crack through the shell and start growing. Because my brother found that he had the best germination when he let a pile of them rot. Almost every walnut sprouted.
Actually, cycads are very similar to that too.
Oh yeah, I think there's a lot of other fruits too that rely a little bit on the fruit to rot, you know, and give them a little bit of, perhaps something it does is give them that extra bit of organic matter that the fungus needs.
Right, yeah. I know they drop a lot of seeds. luckily enough.
Yeah, they do. But they also, you know, one of the interesting things about these, when we see these nut forests and oaks, hickory forests, is there's squirrels. They the squirrels population, they just seem to love them because they love the different nuts and I found they really went after the hickory nuts.
All right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, we used to have shag bark hickory. That was one of the trees that would sprout in these nut forests. And the shagbark hickory, have you ever seen those?
I don't think I have.
Well, yeah, you'll absolutely remember them when you do, because they got an interesting bark, as the name says, shaggy. And the bark will peel off in these little slabs, you know. So it gives the tree a shaggy appearance.
I think I would have remembered that, but I don't. So obviously I haven't seen it yet.
Well, would you get a chance to visit
when I'm in Indiana?
Yeah, when you're in Indiana, you'll central Indiana, you'll probably be able to see some. Now, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, it seems like that the nut trees did not mind the undergrowth. That sometimes, you know, you'd find a lot of plants. That would grow underneath them, but the hickory or the oak trees, Ken, were something different. Underneath the oak tree, it'd be almost bare ground.
Yeah, we do have oak trees up here, and I asked about that actually. Can you tell our listeners why it's bare ground under the oak tree, Ken?
Oak trees do not like competition, so. They produce a toxin called tannin in their leaves, and what this does is it basically acidifies the ground around these trees so that other plants cannot grow. So interestingly enough, that's what this oak tree does. It's poisoning the ground, and so you don't see a lot of plants at all growing underneath an oak tree. It's many times they'll be mostly barren. Sometimes you'll find a little grass that can take it. Sometimes you'll find a few little scraggy plants. Poison ivy was one that could do better than some underneath the oak trees, I noticed. But for the most part...
One thing I did notice with the oak, too, is their leaves are somewhat resistant to deterioration, too, aren't they?
Yeah, they're very tough. And they'll coat the ground, too, so that also puts a coating on. And so that's why, you know, what we have there then when we have this type force. Now, when we start moving on, we'll see a few other plants start moving in as well. These different forests have an understory of other growth because the one woods that I used to love to go to and visit that had the oaks and the walnuts and hickory nuts. Also had a few other trees. It had maples starting to grow in it. And it also had occasional beech. The beeches back in India, I noticed, they weren't doing too well when it come to making fruits. I noticed that beech trees, for the most part, do have trouble. They only produce good fruits every so often, almost between 5 and 8 years. Ken, did you know that?
No, I didn't.
It's really iffy.
At all, is it?
Yeah, I found it kind of an interesting... how do these things actually breed? Because the one woods, when I was young growing up across, had a lot of beech maples in it. So I had like I said, I've got to see all these different stages, you know. Now I'm thinking about another little woods that was close by. It had mostly nut trees in it as well. But it had a lot of other undergrowth. I don't think there was too many oaks in it. It was mostly the oak and hickory. And had a few other small shrubby plants that grew in it. So we see all these, you see all these different little plants that can grow, in these different habitats, and they change. Each habitat changes.
Actually, I've got a tree I planted in my garden that was a native tree to our area, and it's a flowering dogwood. I believe we're on the very northern limit of its range, but that would be prevalent through your beech maple forest too, wouldn't it, Ken?
That it would. Actually, when we start talking a little bit about the plants, Ken, it's on my list here.
It is. Oh, good.
Yeah, that's real interesting to bring it up because, but we'll talk. We're getting ready to go into the plants of Ginn's Woods.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, now as I mentioned here, we're seeing where the oak trees now. I think what's funny is that song by Rush. I think it's what Trees. I think he kind of had his analogies a little bit backwards because what we're going to see here now is the tree that can outreach the oak trees even, is the maples. And in the song Trees, I think he mentioned how why the, you know, the maples can't be happy in the oak shade. But the problem is the maples will actually outreach the oaks, and the oaks are the one that has to live in the maple shade. And maples or oaks can't do it. They die out. So
that could be the difference between a Carolinian forest and a beech maple forest.
Yeah.
Because yeah, oaks are fairly prevalent up here.
Well, once we got to the the thing about Ginn's Woods, I don't believe I've seen any oaks in it. Nut trees were so few and far between that you couldn't, you know, you really couldn't say nut trees lived in it. It was dominated by sugar and black maples and the occasional beech tree.
Right. Up here, it's very, very, you see the occasional sugar maple, but not very many.
Oh,
that's
some of these
the
woods.
Difference, I think.
Years ago, I used to have a motorcycle. Nice road bike. And I loved going by woods that had sugar maples or black maples in it. I smelled like maple syrup. Oh, it'd just be so delicious, you know.
That would be a delight.
And, yeah, I kind of miss that, you know. But anyway, it's really interesting, you know, to live by these forests. But I guess, Ken, when we start talking about the plants at Ginn's Woods, let's talk about now here we are tonight at the solstice. I want to wish everybody a happy solstice. The days are going to start getting longer, the nights shorter as we move back into summer. Like the boys are back in town by that song by, who was it did that song? Oh, doggone it. I can't think of it at the same time.
Some sort of lyric.
Yeah, the boys are back in town. Anyway.
Ah, Thin Lizzy.
Thin Lizzy, yeah, thank you. There we go. So, what's, you know, the forest right at this point in time has lost, you know, it's shut down for the winter as we take our walk into Ginn's Woods. We had this nice little place you could park just off the road. It was out in the country, so nobody bothered you, you know, and had some nice paths that through the woods, you know. So as we walk through the woods this time of winter, now you're saying back that area, you're having a mild winter, right?
Once this year, and that melted that same day, and we haven't had any since.
Okay. Yeah, because it's interesting when you'd go on a day when there's no snow, there would be no snow in the woods. But there would be the trees, you know, that already shed their leaves. All the other plants have been hit by frost, died down. So you've got basically bare trees and the dead undergrowth. It's usually not thick. That's one nice thing I liked about the woods, too. It wasn't a thick undergrowth because it was a shady place. And a lot of the undergrowth had its maximum growth during the springtime. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes and the reason why. But as you'd walk through, you know, you'd see, along the path, you'd see things getting ready, you know, to totally shut down for winter because winter hasn't taken hold yet. We're still waiting for January to get here, and usually January can be pretty cold back in the Midwest and February. So as winter goes into grips, we see animals that are hibernating. A lot of the squirrels now, they've set in food for the winter. Sometimes they'll come out and hunt some of their nuts or something like that, that they'd bury. But there really wasn't a whole lot of squirrels in this woods. It was not populated too much by that. I think the main squirrel might have been flying squirrels, little tiny guys, because the woods didn't have any nut trees other than the beech trees. and it couldn't support a large population. And I know some of the flying squirrels would come down on the ground and hunt little berries and stuff.
Did you have chipmunks there, Ken?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
Yeah, the chipmunks kind of like the little more open areas. And yeah, I remember one time, a little bit sidelined here, because chipmunks are so cool. I remember at this, I was sitting out early one morning, I got up to, I used to help farmers around Indiana to remove groundhogs because they would cause problems with their burrowing. And this is funny because it's actually one of the last times I started, I hunted as well. But I'm sitting there all nice and quiet and peaceful waiting to see one of them groundhogs poke its head out, you know. And now the nice thing is I never saw a groundhog, so the hunting didn't go good. But this is what was cool, though. As I'm sitting there all quiet, you know, really just blending in with the scenery, this little chipmunk come up and sat down on my foot and just
really?
Sat there and had a little bit of a seed it was eating.
Wow, that would be so cool.
Well, I packed up my gun and went home.
Yeah.
Well, that's it.
Blame
you. Yeah, it's like, that's it, you know. It's, I'm done with it. Because I enjoyed that chipmunk coming up. It's like, yeah, I'd rather take pictures of these things. So that's what happened.
Actually, Ken, could I just remind everyone that if they've got a question for us, please go into our chat room and where I am and ask us in there. Because of problems we've had in the past, we don't take calls anymore, not live calls. And, you know, that's the problem. One too many persons did the wrong thing and everyone's got to suffer for it. So can I just remind everyone, please, if you've got any questions, go into the chat room on www.naturetalkshow.com and ask away there.
And Ken and I will try to do our best to make sure we have the answer for you. And if we can't get it this time, we will definitely answer it for you on the next show that we do. So we do that as well. So we're happy to do that because this is fascinating
stuff. Wait a second. Let me just stress this. The caller just hung up. Okay, so hopefully they're going to contact you through the website. I will let the caller on, but you've got to know that I'm copying numbers down, and I am sharing those numbers for obscene callers. If you got something to say, don't say it on this show, okay? Just don't do it. Don't ruin a good show, all right? So there you go. I mean, that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, we prefer that you use the chat line, and that way more people can meet in there and talk and chat. So that's what we prefer. So anyway, on with the show.
Yep.
Now, where were we?
Well, you had a little chipmunk on your toe.
Okay, time to move on.
You did. Up and went home, didn't you? After
Yeah. It's then I got my camera, and I've got hundreds and hundreds of nature pictures that I took in Ginn's Woods. Now, when we start looking at the very bottom, you know, Ken, there's a when we look at the soil. So we got to look at the soil of one of these woods forests, I believe. Don't you think so too?
Without that, nothing can grow, can it? So it's an important aspect of it.
I think it's basically, you know, the basis of one of these forests, you know, because we got to set up, you know, these leaves. It's interesting how these things build. You know, life is builds upon itself. You know, and when we look at one of these forests here, what we see, you know, it rests this time of year. In the springtime, it starts coming alive. You know, it grows. The trees do their thing, which is basically to live. You know, that's what life does. Life lives. And each organism does its own, form of life that it, its own lifestyle. And the trees, you know, they appear to be sentient beings, appear to be, inanimate objects. But these trees are communicating with each other. You know, all the plants in these forests are communicating with each other's species and the other plants around them. But we see that when we see the oak trees, you know, poisoning out other plants. You know, they're putting this toxin out there to communicate and say, look, man, this is my territory. You're not allowed here.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting to think about that, because there's other plants that when we talk about deserts on our next show, there's a plant out here that's creosote bush that's really bad about poisoning the ground to everything except the creosote bush.
Mm-hmm.
But
Ken, did you ever notice any mycorrhizal fungus in the beech maple understory?
Very good question. Yes, yes. Actually, that's what I was going to get to next, Ken.
Sorry.
The soil.
I'm jumping
no,
the
no,
gun.
You segued right beautifully into it. couldn't have been better. But absolutely, one of the cool things about these beech maple forests is because it's a high organic forest, is you'll see lots of fungi, and usually you'll see it growing in the moist part of the spring when it's starting to warm up. And you'll see all kinds of these things coming to life, Ken. When it comes to fungus, for our listeners out there, the mushroom that you see is not the fungus. That's just the fruiting body. And the true fungus itself, the organism that makes up these, they live underground or in the wood. There's slime molds, there's puffballs, there's shelf fungi, there's the typical mushroom types. These types have gills, some have pores underneath them, you know, just a myriad of forms that these fungi fruiting bodies take. But the rest of the time, they kind of look like, you know, these, like the mold you see growing in a bread or something, you know. That's a fungus. But these are the organisms that are breaking down all the organic material that's in the soil, you know, the leaves that fall. These organisms they produce chemicals and enzymes to start the deterioration of the leaves and they absorb the nutrients from that. Now, here's one really interesting thing, Ken. I think you and I brought this to our listeners' attention on a previous show. And that's that 95% of all green plants require a fungus symbiote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they do utilize that to live, basically, don't they?
And Ken, I think the cool thing about that is it a symbiosis or is it a parasitism that green plants have? Because when we talked about the orchids, you remember, we talked about how these their root cells actually penetrated little parts of protoplasm that penetrated the fungi cells. You know, actively penetrated them. Now, that's parasitism to me in my book.
It's awfully close to it, isn't it?
Yeah, but fortunately, the fungi also get sugars and stuff from the green plants as well, products of photosynthesis. So it becomes like a symbiosis. So when we look at the amount of fungi, and almost every plant species probably has its own species of fungi that's a symbiote with it, because they've been growing together, you know, for tens of millions of years. Well,
and
you trace the lineage back all the way back to the first. That's probably how the original plants started growing on land, Ken. They started a symbiosis with a fungi.
Yeah.
Yeah, to be that many, I guess, I think. But, yeah, fungi, for those who like to take photographs of nature and stuff, springtime is a real good time. Now, let's move on into spring, Ken, and we'll, talk about what's happening in this forest.
Right.
You know,
was that your favorite time of the year, Ken, or did you have another time that was your favorite in that forest?
Actually, you're right. The springtime was. It was my favorite.
Right.
Because so much was happening.
Yeah.
You know?
It's coming to life kind of thing.
Yeah, it was a great time. Now, this is what's kind of cool, is when we start seeing the forest come to life, also along with this forest, Ken, there's an ephemeral pond that's a very big part of Ginn's Woods, you know, because this pool, it covered maybe a half acre when it was full of rain, you know, snow melt and rainwater. And it was home to a myriad of species. And one of the first indications that we had the spring was coming and that ground and thawed, because when the forest is in hibernation, all the trees are hibernating, the sap is down in their roots, and life things shut down, no leaves. The ground freezes up to half a meter, I believe, in that area during the coldest part of winter, you know. And so animals that are able to estivate, sometimes they have to dig deeper than the frost line. Sometimes animals are able to just cover it in the bark and survive under trees, like insect larvae and caterpillar or pupae and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting, you know, how like I said, these woods are just, there's so much to study in these, you know. But one of the first things, I always give me a signal spring. This usually occurred in early March, and that was the sound of the western chorus frogs. Wouldn't you?
What did they do to overwinter camp?
I believe they buried down below the frost line, because
okay.
There's only one frog that can withstand a full-on freeze, and that's the wood frog. And you should have wood frogs in your area.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they're one of my favorites. I think they're just really cool frogs. I always like their color pattern. But
they certainly are stunning.
Yeah. But anyway, when we look at here at the chorus frog, the chorus frogs are cool because they have a little sound that sounds like when you take your finger and you run it along a comb and it makes that little creak sound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I always loved hearing that in the spring. I'd be driving by one of the little pools or something in the area, and if I heard that first chorus frog, it's like, yep, the ground's thawed. And that meant they could, get out, and the water would be cold. Oh, my gosh, I used to go wading in these pools in the springtime, sometimes when there was still a coating of ice. But a lot of things was happening. Let's take a moment and visit the pool if you'd like.
Okay. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, then we'll go back into the woods and see what was happening there, too, because a lot of stuff was going on in this woods. Now, when we look at the pool, it usually, one thing I discovered in Indiana, I raise fish and tropical fish, and one of the things that we used to do, and I still do, I can still collect these things, but we used to go out in the springtime and collect fairy shrimps to feed to our tropical fish. Now, one of the problems I had with fairy shrimp collecting in the springtime, Ken, was that they were always adults, you know. And I'm going, how come we always find adult, you know, it got me thinking about that. I said, there's something going on with these fairy shrimp, you know. They can't be hatching out in the springtime like everybody assumes they're doing. So late one October or early November in Indiana, before it froze, we had some heavy rains come through. And it usually gets real wet that time of year back in the Midwest. And so these pools start filling up in the fall. So I went to this one area that flooded. We got so much water that it even flooded over the road in this one spot you couldn't drive. But I got out there with a fish net, and I started going through the water, and Ken, I pulled out thousands of little fairy shrimp that was about the size of a half-grown brine shrimp.
Ah, all the babies.
They were hatching out in the fall.
Well, they must be tough little buggers.
Yeah.
Be able to overwinter, you know.
Yeah.
Like that.
Well, they didn't seem to mind the ice at all, you know, in these areas. But that's when I found them, for the most part, hatching out. Now, there was a couple places I noticed that they would hatch in the springtime. But for the most part, those fall rains, and you had fairy shrimps. But at any rate, when the pool would fill up, say, in the fall and start getting water, certain things would hatch out. We would start seeing the copepods. There were several types of copepods that would hatch out. Daphnia would hatch out. The fairy shrimp would hatch out. Also, something that would come out of hibernation were little isopods, aquatic isopods. Other creatures that we would see in the fall waters. Flatworms would come out of hibernation. If you got a water sample off the bottom and you start looking at it with the microscope, you'd see things like rotifers, paramecium, vorticella, and other little microorganisms, you know. And these are some of the things that was hatching in the, coming out in the fall. By springtime, when we're looking at the ice starting to melt off, the water was alive with these amazing organisms, you know. The copepod variety, Ken, alone, there was several small species of copepods that are the typical copepod shape, but there's also, there was a predatory species that was long and lanky, and it would go along and hunt other copepods. And it was fascinating to watch these little things. And a water sample, a little swishing the net around, a little fine mesh net, and you would get this whole sampling of these little organisms that was swimming through the water column in this pool.
That's pretty amazing. I've heard of carnivorous copepods, but I've never actually seen any.
They were neat. These had a red body on them, and their antenna, they were almost twice as big as the common copepods we'd see in the pools, you know. And what was fascinating, too, about the copepods was the colors on. So some of them were red, some were bluish, gray, you know, just beautiful little animals for their size. But
do you think that would be dependent on the on what they ate?
I think it was species.
Right, so it's just the animal color.
Yeah, I think it was a species. Because, no, this is interesting. We'll have to do a show about ephemeral pools, totally mm-hmm. on them. Because when the farm I remember growing up on, out in the country back in Indiana, out in the barnyard, it was grass over, you know, covered with grass, and it would hold puddles of water in the spring and winter, or late winter and springtime, where it'd melt, and it had red copepods and blue copepods living in the same little puddles, just mud puddles, and they dry up within a few weeks. But I found it amazing to go out there and find copepods living, you know, in the middle of a barnyard.
So they produce eggs? Well, they're not eggs, actually, are they? They're more cysts, aren't they? And then
and I guess
they die.
I guess they could die after that. Yeah. Well, yeah, the adults would die off. But I think these eggs could be blown around by the wind, you know, to pop up in strange places.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, this was the myriad of life. Now, what was another interesting thing that's happened, when, you know, I was talking about the chorus frog. Actually, the earliest animal that we would see in these pools, and they would come out while there was still ice on the pool and still snow on the ground. And you ready for this? This is an interesting creatures.
What's that?
The tiger and Jefferson salamanders.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I would have thought that they would come out much later.
You would find them doing their mating dances under the ice.
Wow.
Yeah, I found it amazing how often in the early spring when I would be breaking through like a little crust of ice on a pool and collecting salamander eggs at the same time.
Well, I can see I'm going to have to start going out earlier.
Trying to find some. Yeah,
wow.
Really fascinating, isn't it?
It is, actually. Well,
and
I've adapted to it.
Well, this is what was cool, Ken. Believe, even as we look at ephemeral pools, there's top predators, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular pool, the top predator was the tiger salamander. And in the frogs in the springtime, now to feed on, the Jefferson salamander larvae were probably prey too, because these pools had lots of Jefferson salamanders, but it had enough tiger salamanders to make an impression. But they had chorus frogs, spring peepers, gray tree frogs, and American toads would all lay their eggs in the same pool. Chorus frogs come out first. Then the next ones you would hear would be the spring peepers and then the gray tree frogs. And the tiger salamanders, you know, they would already be hatched out and ready to start preying, you know, on these little tadpoles as they were ready to, you know, start hatching. So from the chorus frog on, you know, these salamanders had these tadpoles to eat.
Well, that's an incredible diversity of amphibians, isn't it?
It is. I loved Indiana for the amount of amphibians. There was a whole ton more of other things, too. But as you can see, this particular pond was amazing, and then occasionally a painted turtle would visit it.
Wow. And how do you know how they overwinter?
Painted turtles are interesting. Usually they would just go down to the bottom of the pools. And I've had kept painted turtles in pools back in when I was growing up, living out that farmhouse. I had a pond freeze one time, a swimming pool, those little wading pools,
right.
And the painted turtles got caught in the ice, and it didn't mess them up at all. They could
wow.
take freezing in the ice. I was impressed. No frostbite or anything on them.
That's very hardy, isn't it?
Very, you know. And occasionally, but the painted turtles will migrate. And that's how a painted turtle will occasionally end up at this pool.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, other things that we would see also in the water would be mosquito larvae, midge larvae, dragonfly, and damselfly larvae, or nymphs. To name some of the commonest insects that would appear. And the pond would last until maybe late spring into early summer. And then plant-wise, algae grew in it, and there was another interesting little plant that actually had a submerged and an emergent leaf on the same stalk, and it's called crow's foot. Have you ever heard of that?
I don't think I have.
Well,
what can you tell us about crow's foot, Ken?
Well, when it's growing underwater, it's got a beautiful lacy leaf pattern. Looks like a kabamba or something like that, you know?
All right.
It's really pretty. But once it emerges, it grows heavier leaves and it flowers. And the flowers are like little burrs, stick tights. Is what we called them, and you'd be wading through that pond area, not thinking too much about it in the fall, and you'd get a gajillion of those stick tights sticking to your clothes because the seeds had these little spines that they used to stick the fur of animals, and that's how they would get themselves transported around. But they liked low, wet areas, and that was the main plant that would grow across that little pool, and it'd be about a meter deep. At its deepest.
Wow. and it only grew in the summer. In the spring, or was it all summer? It was there.
The crowsfoot.
Crowsfoot, yeah.
Yeah, it would grow after the water drained down, and turned fully
right.
emergent.
Okay.
Yeah, and you'd watch a flower and stuff. But anyway, that was the main thing on this pool. Like I said, it was about a half acre in diameter. It was a natural occurring pond in a depression there by at the very edge of this woods. And a lot of the college students would do research there on amphibians. They'd set out little, you bury a coffee can at the end of, at each end of a strand of netting that was strung out. And screen wire, the salamanders mm-hmm. come, bump up against it, and they travel one way or the other till they fell into the can.
Oh.
Yeah, and college students, that's how they collected, because you weren't supposed to collect anything from that woods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, that's the pool. Now, when we look at the ferns that was growing throughout this forest and the plants in the springtime, that was, along with the pool, my favorite time to walk through the woods because plants like trilliums, painted trilliums, nodding trilliums, lady slipper orchids, the violets. That woods had yellow, white, and purple violets, the whole, gamut of these things. Other plants, spring beauties, adder's tongues, bloodroot, mayapple. These were, once again, these were plants that would pop up early, early in the spring. Before the trees sent out their leaves, and they would grow, so the ground would be covered not only with the green, but you have all these beautiful flowers, that would be blooming. That was another main thing. There's a whole slew of other plants too that I haven't mentioned here, flowering plants, because there's so many to discuss. But that was the time of the flowering plants, and you see these big patches of trilliums, or big patches of spring beauties, or adder's tongues, you would also see the return of the birds. That was something that was cool, too. Because now during the winter, I think that was the time of the birds in Ginn's Woods, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being able to see blue jays, cardinals, screech owls and barn owls in the winter, even black-capped chickadees, you know, would be hopping around. I think the red-headed woodpeckers stuck around. But towards springtime, you see wrens and warblers and other birds, you know, moving back in through the and scattered throughout the canopy. But I think probably the birds was the most common animal in Ginn's Woods.
Yeah, I've noticed up here with the Carolinian forest in springtime, it's there's birds everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really it was a great place for bird watching. Now, one of the interesting things when it comes to insects, we would several times a year we would go out to the woods and take a white sheet and a Coleman lantern,
mm-hmm.
and walk in deep into the woods and light the Coleman lantern and sit there and see what was attracted to the light. I believe.
Yeah.
I believe that that same technique still used by insect collectors in rainforest, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Very successfully, too. it's almost a can't fail process.
Yeah. But the,
what kind of numbers and species camps did you end up with, Ken?
Well, one of the great things I like about a beech maple forest, now, it wasn't the forest for butterflies. You only seen just wood nymphs and satyrs, which could like shady woods. But for if you like silk moths,
all right, yeah,
maple, yeah. One interesting thing about the North American silk moths, like the Cecropia moth, the Polyphemus, the Luna, the Promethea moth, the Io moth, most of them love maple, and this tree, you know, this forest being you know mostly maple trees. These big moths were awesome to go there and collect. That's what we would find. You know, you'd be sitting around there. Next thing you know, like a bat-like moth comes flying up, and it was cool. Imperial moths, that was another big moth that would be attracted in this forest. So moth hunting was one of the best things to do. And it was, like you mentioned, you know, how simple it is to use that sheet because they would mm-hmm. come and hang on the sheet and you could just pick and choose what you wanted to collect. And, yeah, I remember the days we used to do that. Going out at night was one of my favorite times to go through a nature watching because especially along waterways, you could see some cool stuff in the water. But those are some of the big moths we used to see. So, as you can see, it was great for something like that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Let's see here. We've covered the birds, amphibians that we've seen there. Now, I guess what we need, I guess what we've talked about now, Ken, is now we've seen the springtime. You know, it's coming alive. Now, the trees are starting to send out their leaves. Beeches and maples hog the sun. So they send out a really dense forest canopy for our listeners who haven't been into one of these woods. It's nice and shady. Real shady in there. Nice. It's a great place. But as we move into summertime now, we start seeing the ground getting a little bit dry. Some of the wildflowers are starting to die back now because they don't like living in the shade. So they go into resting stages. A lot of these, like trilliums, will stay around for a long time. But you see spring beauties. Let's see, what are some of the others? Some of the adder's tongues. There's a few others I don't have down on my list here that I was trying to remember that also they just die back, and you won't see them again until next springtime.
I can imagine what that's like. Trillium's the provincial flower of Ontario. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that. That's really cool. Because trilliums are beautiful.
And,
I love trilliums.
They are really attractive little flowers.
And I've seen the painted nodding and toad shade, all those different ones. I think the nodding is one of my favorites.
Mm. Mm.
But at any rate, a lot of these plants have died back, and you'll see like some of the shrubbery plants that live in there. Now, one of the interesting things you mentioned earlier, Ken, was dogwood.
Yeah.
Now, dogwoods, you'd see sometimes you run across one of those. They're a beautiful flowering plant in the springtime. You see the beautiful white flowers. Another one of my favorite trees that grew in the that was a small little, not a tree, but a small shrub, I guess.
Yeah.
Red buds.
All right, I've heard of them too.
Yeah, they were very common there in central Indiana. Matter of fact, I transplanted a bunch of from a woods to that farmhouse we used to live at. Last time I was there, they were still growing. They were like 20 feet tall or more. And
wow.
Planted them when I was like 15.
That would have been a good sight in spring when they were all flowering.
Mm-hmm, yeah. That's why I transplanted them. It was kind of cool. Now, another interesting plant, too, a small tree that grew in Ginn's Woods was the pawpaw or Indian banana.
Yeah, that's different. I get a vision in my head when I hear pawpaw because we have, that's a fruit you call papaya.
Oh,
in Australia,
different
thing. We call them, yeah, in Australia, we call them pawpaws.
Oh, we're doing, yeah, because the pawpaw is a little kind of semi-banana-shaped fruit. Only gets a few inches long, but it's got a few seeds in it, but it tastes kind of like a banana. And I've watched one of the greatest things that we saw when it comes to taking photographs in Ginn's Woods was finding the pawpaws in bloom, because we never could seem to catch that particular window. And my friend and I, we happened to go on a picture-taking trip to the woods, and we came up on them blooming.
Wow.
They have a pretty purple flower.
That would be fortunate.
It was, yeah. That was a lot of things on some of this stuff, was timing, you know, being there at the right place at the right time, you know, and seeing some of this stuff happen. But as we move into summertime now, we start seeing the other trees are matured out. The plants, that do live in the understory, you know, they're trying to put on a little bit more size. We see the leaves are reaching their maximum growth by late summer. Now the ground's starting to dry out a little bit, so we also see a lot of the ferns that live in this forest die back because there's almost a dozen type of species of ferns that I found in that forest. It was really awesome for ferns, you know, upland
mm-hmm.
ferns. And as we move to, this show's going quick.
Yes, it is. I was just thinking that myself.
Yeah. But as we move into summertime now, we hear other insects, cicadas, katydids. You know, they start coming out. You know, you'd hear the buzzing of the cicadas in July and August. Katydids at night, especially, you'd be there in the woods hunting moths. And millions of katydids around you doing their little sound. You know, I used to love hearing that. So we see that, passing through that phase. You know, the young birds have been growing up. You know, the young squirrels that were born are growing up. They're starting to get a little size on them. Then we see as we move in the fall, you know, the trees start and different organisms, the fruits ripening up. The leaves start turning color. Now, one of the cool things about a beech maple forest is they're beautiful. Maple trees, to me, turn some of the most gorgeous colors in the fall.
Right. Yes, they do. All sorts of colors, don't they?
Yeah, they're just beautiful, you know. And to be able to walk through, I always like walking through the woods when they're, the trees are shedding their leaves too. That was another one because I spent a lot of time growing up in these woods. I can't say how much time. But at any rate, as we move into fall, you know, we start seeing plants getting ready for the, to shut down. The leaves start turning colors, you know, as they quit producing chlorophyll. The plants get ready to shed their leaves because this is a deciduous forest. So they start setting bud for the next year. And that's one thing I found interesting, too, is when you start looking at different flowering plants, like for fruit and stuff. They'll set their bud the year before they actually fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing to remember for gardeners, too, is check your set, how well it's setting the year before. So
you don't want to trim all them off, do you?
No. That's when you're going to, have your harvest from that. And same way in these woods, these things are setting up for the next year. So if it's been a good year, they'll set a real good, nice buds that get set in. seeds are, you know, everything's just ready to go. And the forest, as it starts cooling off, starts shutting down. And we return to the solstice day and back to winter.
Okay, I've got a quick question for you there, Ken. You haven't mentioned deer. Now, were those woods too small to have deer, or were they present there?
Actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I looked here at my list of mammals, and I did write it down, white-tailed deer. Most of the time I lived in Indiana, deer were scarce. Matter of fact, in Delaware County, to see a deer there, it was like, oh, yeah? What have you been drinking or smoking, you know?
Really?
Yeah, wow. Very rare. But because they were so rare, nobody hunted them. And they eventually started making a comeback, and I remember being surprised, almost out of my shoes, when within about 10 feet of me, this white-tailed deer come bouncing through there in Ginn's Woods. Once again, it was another photo trip, and it went by so fast I didn't have time to get my camera ready. But it was like a deer.
They are quick,
and they're magnificent animals. I like deer, that deer had started returning to Ginn's Woods.
Oh, that's good. That's good to know. That means everything's working as it should.
Yeah. Well, anyway, for our listeners, that's a beech maple forest and some of the main things that you will see when you go and visit one. There's a whole lot more, too, Ken, that can be covered. And I just, researchers, for our friends out there, springtime will be here pretty soon. And if you don't live in Indiana or around, take a trip and go visit one of these places, to some of the state parks and that are in these states, you know, because they're very beautiful. You want to learn more about the plants and animals? Well, go on and you can go online and look up a whole myriad of books, or you can get a hold of Ken Borman here because he is the owner of Lisa Lair's Books. And I'm sure Ken could order books or recommend a good book too as well. Ken, we're at the end of the show.
We are. And it's been a great show, too.
I had fun talking about Ginn's Woods with you. Like I said, it takes me way back to, you know, some of the coolest times with my friends going out there just to take photographs, you know, just to walk around. So, well, real quick, then, I want to mention to our listeners, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. You can go to www.blogtalkradio.com/NTS and push on the follow button and the like button for there. So, also, go visit Nature's Talk Show on our website, www.naturestalkshow.com. Check out and sign up for the newsletter. There's a PayPal button. You can go on our site to help donate and keep our show here running. Also, you can visit our store for coffee mugs, shirts, and more. Visit our chat room, as Ken is in there waiting for your comments or questions and or suggestions for shows. Also, you can listen to our archive shows, and we've got a whole bunch of new stuff on our website, too, that you need to go check out. Excuse me there. Now, I would like to mention real quick that coming up on the first of the year, Nature's Talk Show, where Ken and I are going to be moving our Monsters of Nature habitats. And let's see, what else are we going to be moving Sunday? A Nature's Talk Show and the Green Scene. Listen to us on Sundays, and we'll be doing it an hour earlier, 8 o'clock Eastern Time. Also, our Saturday lineup of Better Time, The Cichlid Show, Killy Show, and The Herptile Hour, which is it's going to be hosted by Chris Weatherford coming up in January. That's going to be on Saturdays at the new time of 8 o'clock Eastern. Fine Art of Paleontology and Tank Topics is going to be at our regular time. It's 9 p.m. So let me stutter that out there, Ken.
Now everyone knows what to expect.
Well, it sure had me confused.
We're right now.
Yeah, here we go. I got it together, Mary.
I'm proud of you, okay?
Oh,
and
me too.
All of us here at Nature's Talk Show would love to wish everyone a very Merry Christmas and a Happy Holiday. And this will be the last show of this week. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. And we have two more for the rest of the year.
And then we shall see you all Monday. And have a happy holidays, everyone.
Merry Christmas. And bye-bye.
And from us here in Canada, too. Good night.
Good night.
Join us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.